You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Author Amy Pichula covers the curious case that left two men dead and the incredible story still surrounded by controversy, speculation, and myth. In 1982, Tony West and Avery Brock made a visit to notorious Corpsewood Manor under the pretense of a celebration. They brutally murdered their hosts. Dr. Charles Scudder and companion Joey Odom built the castle in the woods in the Tryon Forest after Scudder left his position as professor at Loyola University. He brought with him 12,000 doses of LSD. Rumors of drug use and Satanism swirled around the two men. Scudder even claimed to have summoned a demon to protect the estate. The murders set the stage for a trial vibrant with local lore. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Corpsewood Manor Murders in North Georgia, with my special guest, former attorney and author Amy Pichula. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Amy Pichula.
Thank you so much, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. This is incredible, as we just discussed before the program, almost a perfect episode for Halloween. And being close enough to Halloween, this will have to suffice for all those people that think they've heard everything. Let's start off with just your background, because you are familiar with this Corpsewood case from, as you write, from both a legal and a paranormal standpoint. Tell us about your legal career and how else you're connected to this case.
Okay, thank you. I practiced law for 20 years in the Lookout Mountain Judicial Circuit, which is in the northwest corner of Georgia. I started out in the DA's office and began hearing about this case from day one. It made big news around that area. It actually made international news, and they continued to talk about it for decades later and up to the present day. When I'd been practicing for 20 years, I decided it was time to do something else. I retired and started Chattanooga Ghost Tours. And at that point, I started hearing about the case from an entirely different angle. So this seemed like the perfect book for me to write, since I knew it from both sides.
Absolutely. Now tell us a little bit, the setting for this story. You talk about Chattanooga, Tennessee, but tell us about where this little sleepy little town of Tryon, Georgia is, population 1,700. Tell us where it is.
Tryon is a very tiny town, about a half an hour from Rome, Georgia, above Rome, and about an hour from Chattanooga. It's in Chattooga County, Georgia, and a very sleepy little town with a lot of old-fashioned people in it.
Wow. What you talk about, it's weird, obviously we're talking about the Corpsewood Manor murders, but also what the area is really famous for, and you talk about this Paradise Garden and this nationally known folk artist, Howard Finster. Tell us a little bit about this legendary person from this area.
All right. Well, when I first started practicing law, which was back in 86, Howard Finster was not known as a folk artist. He was known as the crazy street preacher out there on the courthouse steps, and will someone please make him go away?
Right.
He's also known around town as the bicycle repairman. He was actually a very nice man, but he didn't start doing art until he was 60 years old, I believe, when he said he heard a voice from God that told him to paint sacred art. And he said, I don't know how to paint. And the voice told him, how do you know? So he decided he'd give it a try. He pulled out a dollar bill, slapped it up, nailed it up on a piece of wood, and drew his first picture of sacred art, which was a drawing of George Washington. And he's been doing art ever since. He felt like he had a mission that he had to get a certain number of pieces of art done, and every piece of art you'll find that he does has a number on it. It's his number in the count. And he apparently finally got his last piece put on and died around the time some other weird happenings were going on in this area.
Now, he achieved some international fame also via some pop bands, rock bands in the 80s as well, didn't he?
Right. Well, like I said, he's become an internationally known folk artist. His art's been featured at the Smithsonian even before. But part of that is because he was put on the cover of some albums by Talking Head and R.E.M., so
right.
After that, you know, his fame just sort of blew up, which was really not his intention necessarily. You know, a lot of people started coming around because they'd heard of him from that. And you know, Howard, he wasn't the type to be overwhelmed about anybody's reputation. So, you know, it didn't matter if they were famous or if they were nobody. You tell them, yeah, they're welcome coming in. Come on in. They could camp out on front lawn if they wanted to. But you know, that's how he saw it. But yeah, he'd had a couple of pieces of his art put on the album covers.
Now, you write about some other incredible crimes that happened, and you talk about the fall of 1982 with teen Judith Neely and husband Alvin, and kidnapped a 13-year-old, Lisa Ann Milliken. Tell us a little bit about this and a couple of other ones, including well, a little bit about the Tri-State Crematory and the Hayward Bissell and his crimes.
Okay.
Just to outline just the small area and then the crimes that occurred there.
Okay. And I'll explain a little bit because I don't know that it's really clear in the way the book wound up coming out in its finished version. My idea is there was something really weird going on to have
right.
this small of a town, 1700, have this many serial killers and really, really bizarre crimes. And I thought it had some connection with this case, and they all stopped when Howard Finster died. My publisher said, no, you can't write about, you know, all the stuff that you have in here. You have to focus on Corpsewood, and you can only say a tiny bit about the others. But that's why you only see a little bit about those, and it is why they're in there. Judith Neely was the first, the youngest woman ever to be sentenced to death row in the United States. She had been an honor student. She had never been in trouble before. And then she marries this guy, you know, Mr. Neely, and he was much older than her. And sometime, you know, after they traveled around a little, they did some small kind of nonviolent crime. But then sort of after they came to or came through Chattooga County, things sort of took a different turn. And they did some of the worst murders that I've ever heard of. One of them was a murder that occurred, in Chattooga County. Another one that has a connection with Chattooga County, but I think the murder itself actually happened down in Rome, was a little girl named Lisa Milliken. Lisa was 13 years old. She was in, I guess, what would have been called a home for wayward girls sort of back then. She'd had a bad situation at home. And basically what they did is they kidnapped her from a mall and raped her multiple times. Injected her with Drano, shot her, and threw her body off a cliff for no apparent reason than other for fun. For someone to be doing this who'd never been, like I said, in any kind of trouble for anything violent before, it was just unheard of. Howard Bissell likewise, never been in trouble before in his life. Now, Howard was a schizophrenic, but he, you know, never engaged in anything violent. He came down from Ohio, where he was from, with his girlfriend, who was a little tiny girl. She weighed less than 100 pounds. And he was a great big guy. He was like 400 and something pounds. And the voices in his head were giving him directions. He was supposed to be on his way to Florida, but somehow he wound up in Tryon, Georgia, which is not on the way to Florida. And he likewise engaged in one of the most bizarre crimes that you've ever heard of. He killed his girlfriend, cut off one arm, the other leg, was chewing on one of her fingers during his police interview. He'd engaged in other crimes in that same spree. You know, he killed some other people, killed some dogs, whatever. Again, it's like he hit Tryon, Georgia, and just something took over him. There was another murder in there besides the corpse one that I think I talk about. And then also the Tri-State Crematory, which has also made some international news. That's the one where they abandoned the bodies all over the place, has some connection with this case in that the bodies of the victims in Corpsewood were sent to Tri-State Crematory. And it was actually right after Howard Finster's death. I mean, immediately after that, the police officers who'd been out there multiple times before and never saw any of these bones all over the place, suddenly it's like a curtain lifted from their eyes and you know, they discovered this crime. So a lot of weird stuff going on connected with Tryon. The odds are astronomical to have that many bizarre, horrible murders and cases in such a tiny town.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you talk about, you say the story starts in 1976, but we'll go back further than that to Charles Lee Scudder, who was born in 1926, and you say, which was unusual, both his parents attended university. Tell us a little bit about Charles Lee Scudder and a couple of his marriages, and before we talk about how he ends up in a mansion in Chicago.
All right. Well, like I said, his mother was college educated, which back in those days was a very unusual thing. Charles was always sort of a unusual guy. You know, I compare him in my book to Dr. Drosselmeyer, because you hear some really vastly different descriptions of him. You know, everyone says that he was a little eccentric and very likable, one of those people who was almost hypnotic in you know, their speaking manner. Some people will describe him as being sinister, whereas others say, you know, no, he was more like the beloved, affable uncle next door. You know, like just like with the character from The Nutcracker, where you get really bizarre, different descriptions. But Charles had gotten his degree. He did get married briefly to a woman named Helen Kilbourne Hazlett. That was a very brief marriage. And then later he married Borte Bunting, who was actually the daughter of an internationally known poet. They had four children together. And I have looked and looked, and I cannot find anywhere a record of any divorce between them, but they both went on with their lives as if they were divorced. So maybe there's a decree out there someplace, and I just can't find it. I know that Borte got married, you know, several times after that. You know, Charles moved to Chicago. He dabbled in some art. He decided to go back to school, get his PhD in pharmacology. And then later he was the co-director of the Institute for the Study of Mind, Drugs, and Behavior. This was in the 70s, so, you know, you can kind of figure out what kind of experimentation those folks were doing. But like I said, everyone always said he was an eccentric. He dyed his hair purple. He had a pet monkey, you know, just a lot of off-the-wall sort of things. But like I said, everyone always would describe him as being a very nice guy with a lot of charisma.
It is important, though, I think. As you write, though, it is important, I think, that you write that the unorthodox professor did government-funded experiments with psychoactive drugs, and you believe, well, you say believe to be include LSD. I think it's very important, as we'll see in this story.
Right, because the three tubes of LSD, which I said totaled full, they would total about 12,000 doses, all three had government labels on them, and they don't just hand those out on the street to anybody, you know. And considering he was, you know, with this place, and they were doing psychoactive experiments, it only makes sense that's where he got the LSD that was, you know, government grade, government labeled LSD.
Right. We're getting ahead of ourselves, so let's talk about, though, he did these experiments. He had moved shortly after moving to Chicago. Charles met Joey Odom. Tell us a little bit about Joey Odom and how they met, and a little bit about Joey Odom's background.
Okay, Charles was highly, highly intelligent. Joey was very different from him. You know, I'm not saying that he wasn't bright, but Joey never had the chances, the opportunities that Charles did. Like I said, Charles came from a well-off family, was able to go to college and all. I think Joey only had, you know, didn't finish an elementary school education, I don't believe either. It's not, a lot of people will say that they were partners talking about, you know, like almost a marriage. It wasn't really that kind of relationship. You know, I think you could call it a partnership, but not that same kind. They got along really well. They stayed together for decades, but they were also free to have their own, you know, relationships with other people. But, you know, when I've talked to different people about Joey, the word that comes to mind for me when I think of him is fey, you know, almost like an otherworldly creature, fairy-like. You know, play peekaboo and things like that, and things you don't usually see grown people doing. And you know, I've heard some speculation about whether he maybe might have had been someplace on the autism spectrum or something. But he definitely was not one who would carry on the same kind of sparkling intellectual conversation that Charles would. But on the other hand, you know, like I said, everyone always said he was a really nice guy and an incredible cook. He came to be Charles's housekeeper. That's, I believe, how they had first met, and stayed and helped, you know, take care of his kids, Charles's kids, when they would be there, or when they would come and visit. His preference, you know, if it was up to Joey, he would rather there not be any electricity at all. He liked cooking on a wood-burning stove, and of course that's eventually what they wound up with when they came to try him. But he was more about the simple things in life.
So Joey has his rule, and at that time, you write as well, that there was, if they were gay, then they didn't let people know about that. That was, they were in the closet about that. And if he did have any kind of strange religious ideas, Charles, then people at that time didn't realize it as well when they were in Chicago.
It's not a question of if they were gay,
mm-hmm.
you know, and,
yes.
and Charles did have some bizarre ideas. But yes, at that time, that wasn't when you went around trumpeting that sort of stuff to everyone.
Now, they're in Chicago, and he was obviously continuing working. What were the circumstances in which he just started to think that maybe it would be time to move from this prestigious lifestyle and go somewhere else?
Well, he got, I think, sort of fed up with some of the privileged students and their attitudes. You know, I think he felt like, he may not have put it this way, but that a lot of the kids just acted like brats. He was getting fed up with the fact that his property taxes kept going up, while the value of the mansion that they lived in, you know, kept going down and required more and more upkeep. He was tired of the rat race, basically. And so that's why, you know, he resigned from the university on his 50th birthday.
Mm-hmm. They also had less ties to Chicago, as they say, that their parents had died, and particularly Joey Odom's father. Tell us about his demise.
You're going to have to give me a second, because I know I wrote about that, but it's been a minute.
I can tell you that he was attacked by a mugger.
Attacked by a mugger, right? He was attacked from a mugger, died from complications with his injuries, but even though he died, the person who did it only got aggravated battery and got a really minimal jail sentence as a result of it. And even after that, he tried to get out on a technicality, although he was not able to do that. But yeah, it was, you know, when someone dies, you don't, you know, see them getting something that's basically just a little bit of an aggravated misdemeanor.
Yeah. So you write that they decide to leave what you call polite society behind in favor of an alternative civilization of their own creation. Tell us about their two dogs and H.P. Lovecraft.
Their dogs were named Beelzebub and Arsenith. And it took a long time. You know, a lot of people had looked for a long time to find the second dog's name. Everyone knew the first one's name was Beelzebub. But we finally found it on the back of a photograph of the dog at the manor. And they think that it's probably a version of a name of an H.P. Lovecraft character. And, of course, H.P. Lovecraft wrote some sort of paranormal things that there are a lot of people who are members of the Church of Satan, which, by the way, is not the same as devil worshippers, really like
right.
H.P. Lovecraft. He had a character named Asenath Waite, who was a soul switcher. And so a lot of folks think that's where he got the name Arsenith for the second dog. But these were two huge dogs. They were mastiffs. They were supposed to be pretty docile with Charles and Joey, but, you know, if strangers came up, because, you know, given their sort of alternative lifestyle and the fact they drove a Jeep that had a couple of huge inverted pentagrams on it and were known to be sort of different kind of characters, you know, occasionally people would come up to the place that they lived, which I guess we'll probably talk about that in a few minutes, was a hand-built castle that they created themselves. You know, there were some people that came up, as you would expect, in a small, pretty southern town that were looking for trouble. And the dogs would, from what I understand, at least one of them would come up to window level when standing on four legs. You know, these were big dogs. They would just go to each side of the vehicle, you know, wouldn't attack or anything like that, but it also made sure that nobody was getting out who looked like they were causing any trouble unless Charles said it was okay to the dogs to let them out.
Yeah, we'll go back a little bit too, and just that you mentioned that at 50 years of age, Dr. Scudder resigned from the medical school, but before he left, he took three vials, approximately, you write, 12,000 doses of government-grade LSD-25 and a couple human skulls. The school, and you say
right.
The school didn't notice their absence as well. So
that's true. Nobody ever came after. You know, you would think that kind of thing would be, especially the drugs, would be something you'd have to sign in or out. And there are, if you don't mind me digressing just a minute, more than any other case I've ever seen. And like I said, I practiced law for 20 years. There, people are more divided about the victims in this case than any other case I've ever seen. Everyone thinks they're
right.
either angels or demons. I don't think they're either. They were human. You know, they had
right.
some good things. They had some foibles. But there are some of the people who want to think that they're angels that would deny for a long time there were any drugs. Well, I went through the trial transcript, and the vials of drugs were in there. One was full. One was half full. One was empty. So that's, you know, when it's a total of 12,000 doses, that's 6,000 doses left. And I've heard some of those, the angel people, when confronted with that, say, oh, it was a souvenir. Well, that's kind of a weird souvenir to take, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But yes, you know, they took those, and they had a couple of human skulls as well as some replica skulls there at the castle.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about that they, when they came there, they found this dead horse, and so then they named appropriately the drive Dead Horse Road. But they named this Corpsewood Manor for some reason. And also you write that they didn't have any construction experience. And then you also explain, too, that Joey Odom, and again, we digress a little bit, was in a car accident with Charles. So tell us a little bit about this car accident, what kind of injuries he ends up with, and how did they come up with this Corpsewood Manor name?
Okay. Well, the Corpsewood name came from when they arrived at the property. They actually got lost on the first night. When they came down, it was a huge blizzard, and I believe it's the same blizzard that was labeled as the day that it snowed in Miami, which was actually in 1977. A lot of folks will say that they moved in 76, but January 77 was when the blizzard happened. So, you know, they got lost. They wound up having to sleep in their car the first day. You know, they finally find where the property is, and it is not easy to find. You know, a lot of people go looking for it even today, and if you don't know how to get there, you're not going to find it. You know, and they find this dead horse laying in the middle of the road that goes to, you know, to where their property is, like a logging road. That's why they named it Dead Horse Road. They go down there, and then all the trees are dead. Because it's winter, you know, and that's what happens with the, you know, the ones that aren't evergreens. And so that's how they named it, you know, Corpsewood. You know, it was sort of a little inside joke. You know, I've heard people say, you know, they thought maybe that the area acquired its name sometime after their deaths or whatever. No, that's what they named it, Corpsewood Manor. And yes, they had no construction experience whatsoever, either one of them. They read a book on how to build, and built this, a lot of people call it a castle, you know, or manor, by hand themselves with no construction experience. Now, Joey had been in a wreck, I don't think real long after they'd gotten there, and he injured his leg in the car wreck. So, you know, as a result of it, Charles wound up having to do a lot of the, you know, the physical part of the labor in building it. The castle is sort of oblong shaped. It's got rounded, it doesn't have sharp corners. It has rounded corners. Now, some people have speculated that's because, you know, there's some legends about, you know, witches not being able, or ghosts or whatever, not being able to hide in corners. Although the thing that makes the most sense to me is, someone who had said, actually, they think it was just a construction error, that wasn't the way it was intended to come out, but because they didn't have any experience, that's how it wound up. Either way, it's beautiful, or was a beautiful building. But yes, they took them about, I think, a year to get the first floor undercover. Until that time, they lived in a sort of first a tent, and then what they called the chicken house later on, which is a three-story structure they built first, I guess. And after, then the next year, they got the second story under roof.
Right.
The castle, though, it doesn't have any electricity, but they built it with a triple layer of brick with space in between, which is actually, you know, a really good insulating factor, sort of like the way a cave is. So it kept it from getting, you know, too cold in the winter time. As a matter of fact, I believe some of the folks who came out investigating after the murders happened, and some people who were with the victims at the time the murders happened had said it was actually hot in there, even though it happened in December.
Right. Let's stop just for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about this construction, and also what we maybe not mentioned it is that Charles and Joey, they wanted to abandon everything material that they had before. So they didn't have money They did a lot of things on their own. You said they ground their own wheat. They did a lot of things. They planted fruit trees. They were self-sustaining, or at least for the most part, and didn't have to really go in for supplies too much. Tell us a little bit about the lifestyle that they set up for themselves in terms of what I just mentioned, but also the letter writing and the contact and the correspondence that Charles undergone.
Okay. I wouldn't say that they were abandoned all material things, because they shipped a house full, you know, of Renaissance era, very expensive furniture down to this lot where it sat covered in tarps
right.
for a year while they were building the castle. So they did have a lot of really beautiful furniture and artwork. But yeah, they, like I said, they wanted to escape from the rat race. You know, they didn't want to have to be reliant, working, you know, on jobs for other people or whatever. So they built the castle insulated, as I said. They had a well to get water from. They had, I believe, a gas-powered refrigerator. They built a privy, you know, a sort of outhouse, but it's built out of brick and it's very nice. And another area for like a shower where they pumped water from a pond nearby. They had chickens in the bottom floor of the chicken coop that they used for eggs and meat both, I think. They had the fruit trees. They had honey and used the bees for both honey and for beeswax to make candles with,
right.
and made homemade wine. Some of the wine, from what I understand, someone that I'd spoken to along the way said some of it was made just experimentally from all kinds of weird things, vegetables or whatever, and some of it was really nasty tasting. But some of the wine, you know, particularly I imagine what they made with fruit, they said was really good, but it was very strong. But yeah, that was their, you know, Charles had written an article for Mother Earth News before that said, you know, it didn't take that much money to be able to be self-sustaining. It just can't take some determination, you know, and willingness to put in the work to do it.
Right. Now let's talk about this, you know, you write about the sex and game parties, but also that there was a lot of correspondence with men from various places and locations. Tell us a little bit about some of that correspondence, who we did correspond with, and what was the nature of that correspondence?
And this is another part that the people who want to say, oh, they were angels, don't like to talk about, but it's in the court file too. You know, there was he maintained a lot of correspondence with prisoners, and some of it was very, very sexual in nature. Not all of it, you know, but he definitely had quite a bit of correspondence. And, you know, from what I understand, he had a fair amount of visitors that would come to you know, have some, you know, free and easy relations, you know, while he was there. And that wasn't, you know, as I've said, he and Joey, I think, may have had sex for convenience. It wasn't like a, you know, monogamous marital type relationship, so it wasn't ever anything
right.
that bothered him. But yeah, from what I understand, you know, Charles was a pretty sexual person and didn't mind expressing that and experimenting with that.
And Charles was gregarious and invited various people. You say that he was a very big student of psychology and was very interested in human behavior, and also as well, not to say that you provide absolute proof, but this 12,000 doses of LSD-25 could have been possible that some of the party favors would include LSD for some select people, at least at these parties. Wouldn't that be possible?
Yeah, some of the people that I talked to had said that particularly, I know one had said, you know, there was a motorcycle gang that liked to come party with Charles. And that was one of the things that they liked about it. So, I mean, if you're sitting there with that much LSD, it's kind of hard to imagine it just sat there as a souvenir and didn't get used. And there were definitely, you know, there's definitely been talk about it being used. And you know, later on after their deaths, you know, some of what was taken into custody getting distributed.
Right. Now, also that you said that we mentioned that he was an artist at one time in Chicago. Tell us about his continuance in dabbling in art and what kind of art he does do, and also some of the pieces that he has in his own home concerning the occult and Satanism.
Okay. The only piece that I remember, He had done some painting to start with, and he created some stained glass that was incorporated into the manor house he liked to do. He had several pieces of art, and you know, some of it had to do with the Church of Satan. The Church of Satan, just so you understand, like I said, they're not devil worshipers. They're atheists, basically, who came up with that name to sort of poke fun, you know, at Christians. One of the statues, probably, from what I understand, the most valuable piece of art, or one of the most valuable that he had, was a statue of Mephistopheles, which, from what I understand, was pure bronze. It wasn't obvious when you first saw it because it had become blackened. That was one of the pieces that he had. He had some paintings that were there that there were two babies. And if you really study them closely, they're opposites. They're birth and death babies, basically. You know, one would have one hand up, the other would have the other hand up. One looked alive, one looked dead. One was happy, one was sad, whatever. And he had a stained glass Baphomet, some people will say it, which is a symbol that a lot of times is associated with the Church of Satan. It's a goat created out of an inverted pentagram, you know, the two points of the star on the top are his horns, and then or his ears, and the side ones are like horns, and the bottom one is his mouth. And that was something that was inside the home as well that he had created. So that's how, and he had books and things about the Church of Satan, among other books that he had. And that's why this case got to be known as the devil worshiper case around here. You know, up on their chimneys, they had inverted pentagrams on all of each of the four chimneys. You know, there was a lot of that sort of thing around. And I don't think it was because Charles was trying to do anything bad or anything like that, but I think he was fascinated with human behavior of all kinds, and I think he was fascinated with maybe religions of different kinds, and this was, you know, this was certainly prominent among them. There's a lot of intellectuals in the Church of Satan, and that would certainly, you know, intellectual would certainly fit Charles's description.
Right. Now tell us, for people imagining this right now, there's this manor, this castle-like manor, but there is also another building, and that's the chicken house. And you talked about chickens on the bottom floor, but there's three floors. Tell us about the chicken house.
Okay. The chickens were kept down in the bottom floor. The second floor, from what I understand, was a library and contained some pornographic material and some canned goods in there. And then the top floor was what they called the pink room. There was really no furniture in there. There's pink shag carpet, pink sheets, covering mattresses that were on the floor there. You know, it was a great playroom to entertain in. And they also entertained some guests, you know, for non-sexual purposes. The people who eventually murdered them, they were sitting around up there drinking wine before, you know, the murders happened. So that's that was one of the other notorious things that gave this case international attention was, you know, the pink room. And, you know, there's a lot of things that was said about there were some sex toys around or whatever. I have yet to see any photos of the inside of the chicken house. I did a lot of looking for them and couldn't find any. So I can't say for sure about the sex toys, but it certainly was someplace that they entertained guests of different varieties.
You write there was also a guest book. It ended up disappearing, but there was reportedly a guest book. What would be in this guest book reportedly?
Well, the reports were that it had some details in there about some of the guests that they had, including some of the sexual guests that had come to visit. I'm sure it had some of the addresses from some of the people that Charles corresponded in there. And there were also supposedly, from what I've heard from at least one source who claims to have seen it and had his hands on it, photographs in there that could be, considered compromising. There's always been speculation that this guest book had something in there about a prominent figure in town, but it's never been said who that prominent figure was, and even if I heard it, I wouldn't share it here just for their privacy and for safety reasons. So,
right. Now, we are going to introduce this Avery Brock, but he meets Charles and Joey when he's out hunting. So then he's invited back to the house for because he's heard stories about the wine. So he goes over to the house. Tell us about his visit to the house and what ultimately happens, at least maybe not the first time, but at least one of the times when he does visit.
Avery was 17-year-old. He was living on his own. He was basically emancipated. He had come from a bad situation with, I forget if it was his father or stepfather, but so he was out on his own and eventually wound up moving in with Tony West, who was the other killer. But yeah, he was hunting on their land. And like I said, Charles was always, he may have been careful, but he was also pretty friendly with people around as long as they didn't seem to pose a threat, and had, invited Kenneth back to the manor. And I don't think Kenneth had actually ever, until the night of the murder anyway, went into the manor house itself, which was, I think, a source of frustration for him. He had been in the chicken house, which is where they entertain people. The manor was kind of their sanctum. It was only for very close guests. It wasn't for this kind of casual, thing. And from what I understand, Kenneth or Avery had some of the wine, and on more than one occasion had consensual sex with Charles. But then later on, he went back and, he was telling the story to his roommate, Tony. Tony was much older. I'm thinking he was in his 30s or 40s. And Tony had been around the block way more than Kenneth had. He'd been in plenty of trouble with the law, and I'm sure we'll talk about that shortly. But, he was like your traditional, uneducated, redneck guy. And, of course, he wound up, making fun of Kenneth about it, which made Kenneth mad, not at Tony, but, he kind of turned the story around in his mind so that, this was all Charles or Charles and Joey's fault. This wasn't, his doing. Never mind that it was consensual, that he was old enough and out on his own to know what he was doing. And so he started getting angrier and angrier at them and, decided he wanted to punish them for, making him forcing him to have consensual homosexual sex. But there was no force involved. I mean, that's pretty well established. Let me interject here, too, though, that Kenneth, like the other people that I talked about earlier, Judith Neely, like Hayward Bissell, he'd never been in trouble before. So this is another one of those cases of what in the world was going on in Tryon.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why. That's why Ritual's founder is on a mission to reinvent the vitamin industry. Kat Schneider and her team of scientists at Ritual are making clinically tested a new normal. Ritual left out mystery additives, synthetic fillers, and shady extras that can be found in some traditional multivitamins. And they're committed to showing you their nutrients, where it came from, and why they chose it. They call it traceability. My wife Lisa decided to take Ritual about 7 months ago after reading about their specific ingredients, nutrients, and vitamins, and the advantages as compared to other multivitamins, and decided to take Ritual's Essential for Women. She has, ever since, incorporated Ritual in her daily routine of exercise and healthy eating. She continues to feel it's really making a difference in her health every day. Ritual's clinical study of Essential for Women showed an increase in vitamin D levels and omega-3 DHA levels. 40% of women cannot properly utilize the synthetic form of folate, folic acid, which can be found in many multivitamins. This is why Ritual uses folate in its absorbable form to help cover women's needs. Daily changes can lead to big results, so start small today. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Try it out, satisfaction guaranteed. Go to ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, we were talking about the circumstances in which it turns this person that had never been in trouble before, never had much of a life before, not much experiences before, teams up with this guy that lets him move into his derelict trailer, and then they start hatching a plan to do what with Charles and Joey, and based on what? What is their belief, and what is their plan that they start to hatch?
Well, I think that Kenneth and Tony, Samuel Tony West, Kenneth Avery Brock, had some different plans to start with. You know, Kenneth, like I said, he was mad. He wanted somebody to blame about the fact that he had had, you know, homosexual sex, and here's Tony's making fun of him for it. So,
sure.
He wanted to kill them, punish them, torture them. His plan, Kenneth's plan to start with, was that he wanted to rape them with a hot soldering iron. There were a couple problems with that. They thought they would get the soldering iron from the manor after they got there. Well, A, they didn't have a soldering iron. B, they didn't have electricity to plug it in, even if they had had one. So that
right.
didn't really work. Tony, though, was much more of a what can I get out of life kind of guy. So he wanted to rob them. There were there had always been rumors, you know, that or always people that thought that they must be rich, because here they lived without having any, you know, support as far as people could see from independent ways. And a castle in the middle of the forest, and so they must be rich, right?
Right.
So as it turns out, in fact, they kept all of their money in the bank. They would even write a check for an Eskimo pie, which is, you know, like an ice cream bar.
Right.
But that was, you know, what Tony thought. He thought he was going to get some money or jewels or whatever out of it. Now, there were valuable things at in the manor, the artwork, but neither one of them were the kinds to be able to appreciate that and realize that, you know, had any value to it. So that's how things kind of went. Now, Tony wasn't really the kind where it would make much difference to him if he wound up hurting somebody along the way. You know, it just wasn't his goal. His goal was, you know, to get the money and the valuables. And if they hurt somebody along the way, well, no big deal.
Right. Now, they put this plan into action for December 12th, 1982. And so they ask, Brock asks someone for a weapon. So where did they get the weapon from? And what did they do involving, what actions they are involving Myra Haygood and her daughter? Or pardon me, and Teresa.
Let me see. Myra was, okay, there was another boy named Joey Wells who was a cousin. You know, Myra Haygood was Tony West's sister, and Joey was her son, and not Joey Odom, Joey Wells, who was, you know, teenage boy or young man. And they had gotten the gun, I believe, from Myra's trailer, if memory serves. And, you know, Myra and her trailer come into play a little bit later on after the crime. But that was, you know, kind of what her, you know, how she came into it and how the weapon came into it, because they knew they needed something. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't her gun. It was Betty Jo Lawrence's rifle, who that was Avery or Kenneth's mother.
Right.
You know, Joey, like I said, was the son of Myra. Joey had a date that night with a young lady named Teresa Hutchins. And this was their first date. Teresa was a young woman at the time. She had no idea about what was going on the night everything went down. There's been question ever since about whether maybe Joey Wells knew what was going on, but Teresa definitely didn't. And, you know, so Tony West and Avery Brock decide they're going to go up there to the mansion. And I have no idea why they thought it would be a good idea to bring Joey Wells and Teresa Hutchins along. I don't know if they thought it would be a good cover story or whatever. And Tony by this time had been to the manor before himself, but he hadn't engaged in any kind of sexual activity. But I think, you know, Kenneth had said to him, hey, you know, here's these guys, I got some free wine up here. Why don't you come have some? So they decide they're going to go up there, you know, and take Teresa and Joey along with them. They went up to the trailer, and at first it seemed like it was just not the trailer, up to the manor. You know, they were hanging out in the chicken house where, like I said, typically people were entertained up in the pink room. And at first it seemed like just another ordinary, you know, hanging out with some of the locals and sharing some wine kind of evening. It was clear though that Brock and West both had plans already by when they were going up there to go beyond just that. And things kind of broke down fairly quickly.
You write about that on the way there. I think this is very important because I don't really hear this being an issue brought up at trial necessarily in terms of this specific mix of paint thinner, glue, and alcohol known as Tootaloo. And so along the way, they're huffing this. I don't know if all of them are huffing them, but at least the boys are huffing this concoction on the way to the crime scene, aren't they?
Yeah. They were, and Teresa had said at one point in her trial testimony that she had done that herself that night two or three times, although occasionally on her retelling of the stories, she I think has denied that, but she did say that in her trial testimony. So, yeah, they were all huffing this stuff, which is, you know, like a cheap way to get high up there, basically. It's stuff you can buy it all at the hardware store and mix it up in a bucket and, you know, get a cheap, quick high.
Right. You write that they're all drinking and everything seems to be fine. And Joey has, previous to this, tried to dissuade his uncle from doing this, from Tony, from doing this, but he's still sitting there. like you say, the girl, Teresa, doesn't know what's going on at all. But then he goes out under the premise, Avery goes out to the premise to get some more toodaloo, and then he returns. Tell us what happens when he returns and what does he start doing?
Well, he comes back in with a rifle and comes back into the pink room. And Charles, you know, I said before that he was extremely, Charles was extremely charismatic and had almost, according to some people, a hypnotic effect on people, had a good way of, you know, there'd been several times where people had come up intent on starting trouble and he'd managed to defuse the situation. It was a skill that he had. So here, you know, Avery comes back into the room with a rifle and instead of, you know, acting afraid, Charles laughed and said, bang, bang. And it actually worked for a little while. You know, he, you know, to just be playing around, you know, that, you know, Avery kind of, set the gun aside for a bit and sat down and, you know, they chit chatted and drank for about, you know, maybe another 20 minutes. You know, after about 20 minutes more of that, the plan sort of resumed. Charles had gotten up to adjust the lamp and Avery grabbed him by his hair, you know, pulled his head back and put a knife to his throat. Charles, you know, kept on acting as if it was a game, you know. He was saying, what kind of game do you want to play? I'll play your game. Instead of being of that diffusing the situation that time, Brock threw him on the bed and tied his arms behind his back with strips of sheets that he'd cut up. Then started demanding to know where the money was. Where's the money at? Where's the money at? And Charles told him, honestly, you know, he didn't have any. His money was all in the bank. But that didn't obviously satisfy West and Brock.
Now, Brock, this Joey Odom didn't really realize what was going on because he was in the manor away from the chicken house, and so he didn't hear any of the commotion, apparently. So what did Brock go and do in terms of interaction with Odom?
All Joey was doing was cleaning up the dishes in the kitchen, like I said, in a whole different building. Kenneth Brock instead goes, you know, he says that he's going to, you know, go kill Odom. You know, he leaves and winds up shooting both the Joey Odom and the dogs, which were sleeping, you know, in the kitchen. I guess they were afraid that, you know, they might attack if they didn't kill them too. So, you know, he goes down and kills an unarmed man who's doing nothing but cleaning up dishes and the dogs, and then came back to the chicken house, to the pink room, where Charles still was at that point.
Mm-hmm. You write, too, that what he does is that he comes back in and claims that he's killed that man and those dogs. And so then
right.
The killers, you write, savagely drag the professor and Scudder, still bound, down the ladder and into the kitchen where he's forced to witness the evil inflicted by these two killers in his own home.
Right.
And you say that Joey lay on the floor with four bullet holes in his head and one in his arm. What does Charles do, even though he's bound and he's gagged?
Charles basically blames himself for Joey's death. You know, for him getting shot, you know, he says, I asked for this, you know, they'd been trying to, Tony had been trying to make him sit back down. He said, sit back down or I'll shoot you. And that's when he said, you know, I asked for this, you know, because he felt like he was responsible for Joey's, death because he invited these two guys, you know, into the, into their lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say, too, he shoots him in the face. He drops to his knees, but doesn't kill him. And Wes pulls the trigger over and over again, 4 rounds into his head from there.
Right.
Now, what happens with their pursuit of the riches that they think? What's Brock doing now, thinking that these people are dead? What does he pronounce and proceed to do?
Well, you know, at this point, you know, they've killed both Joey and Charles. You know, they, you know, had shot Charles when they, like you said, when they brought him back in. And so they're sort of tossing the house looking for these riches that they believe are there. And they're not finding any money. Tony had fired the 4 rifle rounds. And I believe Charles had also, I was thinking he'd been shot by a handgun that they had taken from the house as well. So they're tossing the house looking for what they think is there. You know, they find, I think, a jar of nickels and dimes. They find a little bit of jewelry that's not very valuable. They find Charles's leather coat, a pair of handcuffs, plenty of wine. The only thing really of any value they found in the house was they found a gold-plated knife, a dagger that had a jewel-encrusted handle, and I think some silver candelabras and the pistol. They didn't take any of the artwork because they didn't. I'm sure they would have if they'd known they could get any money for it. But you know, at that point, they decide that they need to get the heck out of there. When Kenneth had gone out earlier, he tried to start the car that they came in, a Javelin, and it hadn't started. So they decided they would take Charles and Joey's Jeep to leave. The other thing they didn't see that they probably could have gotten money for if they noticed it was the 3 bottles of the LSD. You know, those were in the bottom desk drawer.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, here's this Jeep. This is not exactly, like I said, a Jeep that blends in easily because it does have huge inverted pentagrams on each door. From what I understand, those were on there because they had it was like a military Jeep, and it wasn't ever intended as a, or wasn't originally intended as a any kind of religious symbolism or Church of Satan symbolism or whatever. That was just what it wound up looking like, and I'm sure that made, you know, Charles thought that was a great thing and fit right in with the, you know, the theme of everything else they had there. But it's not, it's something that's easily identifiable as it goes down the road. So they, you know, they took off in that. They poured gas on the floor trying to start a fire and burn the place down, but they couldn't get it to light. But they forced the, you know, Teresa to go with them and Joey Wells, and they take Teresa back to Myra's house, and they basically hold her for a week because they figure, you know, she's of course all freaked out about what's going on. She had no idea this was going to happen, and they figure she would have, you know, run and you know, called the cops or whatever. And she eventually, you know, she went to her family, and her family persuaded her to call the cops when they finally let her go after about a week. But they'd held her to give West and Brock some time to get away, and they said they were going in a different direction than they were actually going to take off to try to throw her off the track. But she, you know, her family said, if you don't go tell the police about this, they're going to charge you too. So when she finally got free, you know, that's what she did. So
what we didn't mention is that when the perpetrators didn't notice, they didn't take any of the paintings. They didn't think it either spooked them, or they didn't see the value, or they didn't want to take them. But they didn't notice a very, very interesting painting and a very, I think, eerie part of this story. This painting was done or commissioned after Joey had a car wreck, and this is a self-portrait by Charles. Tell us some of the details of this painting. the self-portrait.
Okay. All right. Yeah, what had happened was, from what I understand, Joey had a dream in the middle of the night, and he got up and he described it to Charles, and Charles painted it. The self-portrait is of Charles, and it shows his head. It actually shows his head severed, but sitting on a block. But he's gagged with 5 bullet holes in his head. Well, that's how his body was found, gagged with 5 bullet holes in his head. So, and this was done like a couple of years before the murders ever happened. The murderers didn't see this painting. It certainly had nothing to do with you know, what they did to him. It's just one of many really, really eerie things associated with this case. But yeah, that was hanging on the wall there in the manor.
Now, you say finally Teresa was all freaked out. She wanted to tell people, and eventually, she eventually did tell her own family because other people were telling her, trying to protect Tony West. Meanwhile, the perpetrators are heading through Alabama and Mississippi, talking about going to Mexico. Tell us about what happens when they are looking for another vehicle and they see somebody, Lieutenant Phelps, sleeping in a Toyota.
Yeah, well, for some reason, apparently, what I understand is that they were specifically looking for a Toyota. They had pulled over to a rest stop rest up some, and here they see one with this guy, you know, sleeping in his car. It's a Toyota. So it was just what they were looking for because they wanted to ditch this, you know, car that anybody could know this and find something that would blend in a lot more. They force Lieutenant Phelps, he was a military officer, force him out of his car. This was in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And, you know, he's saying, take anything you want, just don't shoot me. Well, they lead him through the woods, over a fence. And this is with, you know, West there, and Brock's moving all of their stuff into the Toyota. West tries to handcuff Phelps to a tree, but to do that he had to unlock the left cuff, and when he did that, Phelps punched him. When that happened, West immediately shot him 3 times in the head, killing him. Took his wallet, took his ID, you know, left him in the woods, you know, in Lieutenant Phelps's car. So, you know, they did wind up, besides the charges here in Georgia, they wound up with charges in Mississippi associated with that as well.
Right.
The javelin they had left, sold it to Joey Wells, Teresa Hudgens' date, and his mother before. So, you know, and they took off in the Toyota, you know, heading originally towards Mexico, but that didn't quite happen either.
Yeah. You say that they argued and then they finally split up. They were heading in different directions, they thought, but ended up back. And tell us about the arrests of these guys and before we talk about the aftermath.
Okay. They were getting on each other's nerves, you know. Here they just committed this heinous crime, and they were arguing more and more. And I think that Kenneth, the younger one, you know, kind of wanted to go home. And, you know, Tony, they wound up in a strip bar and having a fight, and that's where they, you know, split up. And Kenneth Brock hitched and headed back home. He wound up in Marietta, Georgia, you know, a couple hours from his home, called his family. There's been some speculation about, you know, maybe the family's home was bugged and that's how the police found out where he was. But anyway, they went down to the gas station where he was waiting for his family down in Marietta and arrested them with no problem. Tony West, in the meantime, kind of drifts around and he doesn't really know what to do because he doesn't have any family or anybody out west, and it's getting, you know, close to Christmas time, and he says, well, he didn't have anything else to do. He decides to go head back home too. Winds up in Chattanooga on Christmas Eve, And there's a lot of weird things that have happened in this case, you know, both before the murders, after the murders, or whatever, having to do with cars not working. You know, we'll probably talk about that in a little bit. But Tony had just crossed the line into Chattanooga, and the rain was pouring down. I mean, not like, you know, sprinkles or anything like that. This was sheets of rain, and his car runs out of gas. So he's right across the line from Georgia into Tennessee. He sees this bar, the Palomino Club, which is kind of a seedy place, and decides, well, you know, he might as well head there. So he gets out of the car, gets drenched, of course, because it's pouring rain. Christmas Eve, he gets to the bar, yeah. And what does he see outside but a police officer? So being the self-centered guy that he was, he figures, well, if there's a police officer there, it must be because they're looking for him. So he approaches this police officer with his hands out, ready to be cuffed. And the police officer has no idea who he is or what he's doing. And, you know, Tony's like, okay, go ahead, take me in. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? He's like, you know, I murdered them two guys in you know, Tryon, Georgia. You know, go ahead and arrest me. He was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Tony keeps on and, you know, gets the guy to look him up on, you know, the report, you know, internet stuff to find him. Didn't originally find him and was going to let him go. And Tony's like, no, I'm in there. And so he finally calls Chattooga County, and they confirm, yes, there's these two murderers that we're looking for. Arrest him. So, you know, he did. I've never heard of anybody who went to such lengths to get himself arrested. But so the officer finally arrests him. Then there's a quandary because he's in Chattanooga, and the case is in Georgia. Because the police officer originally just drove him down to Rossville, Georgia, right across the line, and they're waiting for Chattooga County to show up. They have time. They don't even have him in the cell. He's sitting out in, like, the waiting room smoking a cigarette. And so the police from Chattooga County get there, and they're worried because he's crossed state lines to bring him down here. So they drive him back up to Chattanooga, make him get out of the police car and walk across the state line back into Georgia to surrender himself to them to make sure they don't have any kind of problem with that over the arrest. So that's how, you know, Tony eventually got arrested in this case.
Now, they have they get appointed attorneys, both of these killers, and you're mm-hmm. writing that there is barely a month after the arrest. They already have quickly they get indictments by the grand jury. Brock mm-hmm. is offered life over death in exchange for a guilty plea, and he accepts. So
right, and
I guess what happens
right.
is that now we only have a Tony West trial. Tell us what happens in this case with these murders.
Tony confesses about 8 times, you know, and he, you know, may include different details or whatever. And then a couple weeks before trial, the DA's office reveals to the defense that they, you know, they mentioned sort of in passing something about these LSD, you know, vials that they found. Nothing had really mm-hmm. been said about it before, but of course the defense attorneys jump on that. Tony
right.
has not said word one in any of these 8 confessions about LSD. Well, suddenly, you know, once this comes up, he creates this huge story about, you know, how they had drugged him without his knowledge, and that he thought that the dogs were lions, and that he saw himself floating out of his body, and things were glowing, and the trees were glowing, all kinds of just garbage. He did eventually right. confess at trial that, oh, yeah, by the way, I did research LSD while I've been sitting around in jail waiting for my trial. You know, so of course he made the whole thing up. But that was his story, and he was sticking to it, that this was, you know, they brought it on themselves because they drugged him without his knowledge, never mind that he hadn't mentioned a word about that before. So, you know, that is what happened. The judge in this case had told the prosecutor, the prosecutor was a new guy. He is now a judge in the circuit, and he was determined, you know, he was that he was going to make a name for himself, that he was going to do everything by the book and do everything right and get a death penalty sentence on this guy. And the judge was like,
right.
You know, ain't nobody around here going to vote to give the death penalty, you know, for killing a couple of queers. The judge was fairly redneck. And that just made the prosecutor more determined to do that. The judge had made some mistakes in the case. They constituted the grand jury wrong. Back then, they had a way of picking a grand jury where basically they had commissioners that they decided who's going to be on the grand jury. And, of course, they picked all their buddies and all the people they knew were good Church Biden folks. Well, that's not really legal. And the prosecutor had tried to tell the judge, hey, we need to throw this case out before we get started and get a new grand jury and reindict them, you know, the right way. And the judge was like, nope, you know, we're good. So Tony winds up getting convicted. He gets the death penalty and the case gets thrown out because they'd done the grand jury wrong. They worked out something for Tony to be able to plead to life. You know, the defense attorney, who by this time had been switched to one of the best attorneys in the circuit. And they tried to do the plea in front of the same judge. And the judge decides mid-plea, he's not going to take it. So it took a lot of doing. They finally wound up getting a different judge assigned to the case, one from out of town. And they're finally able to you know, get Tony to enter a plea to life instead of the death penalty. So that's, you know, that's what eventually happened with the case.
What we didn't mention and is so incredible is the newspaper, the media's reaction and its behavior, and also the trial itself is an indictment, the defense attempt to indict Charles and Joey for their lifestyle, but especially Charles, and the satanic elements and the drugs and the LSD-25, trying to cast doubt that on their character and deflect from, again, like you say, the killer, these two killers that had never really done anything. Well, Brock had never done anything before, but certainly it was an indictment. It was certainly an indictment in the newspapers and at trial of Charles and everything about his lifestyle, hinting and intimating many things in that trial, didn't he?
Right. I mean, the defense attorneys were doing, you know, whatever they could, throwing out any mud they could to try to kind of cover over the facts that these guys had cold-bloodedly killed these two men, unarmed men, in their own home. You know, when the LSD came out, like I said, they made a big deal about that. You know, they got the letters from the home about some of the correspondence that Charles had with prisoners. So they were making a big deal about, you know, like I said, hey, this is a really small town and a lot of rednecks around there. So, you know, they're making a big deal about the lifestyle, you know, and all kinds of, you know, accusations to try to rile up, you know, the defense thought that they could, that their juries would be redneck enough that they were going to ignore the facts and, you know, wouldn't do anything to these two guys that had killed these, you know, these fellas. And their defense had some to do, I think, with some of the bizarre stories that wound up getting reported there, you know, ever since then. I mean, there are people to this day that'll say, yeah, they had a drug lab down in the basement. Well, this home didn't have a basement. You know, it was built on, you know, solid foundation, two above the ground floors. But I've heard people swear they'd been down in the basement before, because what happens is where the base was for the staircase, there's cement there now. And so there's been some big stories that have been circulated about, oh, that's where, you know, the government, to keep everything hush hush, poured concrete down the stairs that went to the basement. So, but a lot of that just arises from all the dirt that the defense was trying to throw out during this trial.
You write too that the defense trotted out a couple doctors at the Institute for the Study of Mind, Drugs, and Behavior at the Stritch Medical School They confirmed that Scudder had conducted experiments on the effects of drugs on mind and behavior for the military. So they tried to have that as an alternative motive, cast some doubt to the perpetrator's guilt.
Well, their theory behind that was Charles is continuing to do experiments all on his own on locals, or whatever. And while he may have shared, not just his wine, but, some drugs with locals who were voluntarily imbibing it, there's never been any credible evidence that he's ever, drugged anybody without their knowledge. But that's what, that's what they were trying to imply, because they were doing everything they could to try to, save their client's butt.
And so West tried to claim that he had the effects of LSD. He tried to point fingers at Wells, but to no avail. But he did attempt to have, with his behavior and with that idea that LSD affected him, didn't he?
Yeah, like I said, that was kind of where his defense was, although he did eventually admit he researched LSD before he started telling this story, and hurt his 9th or 10th retelling of the tale, that, like I said, he didn't know what he was doing. He was in an altered state of mind because they had drugged him without his knowledge, and he was hallucinating, blah, 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 but
now,
not supported by any kind of facts.
What was the behavior? We talked about the behavior of the newspapers, but what about the behavior of the public in terms of their desire for souvenirs? Incredible, the story you tell about that.
People in that area had they kind of heard there's this weird little, house up there. Some people would go up there and try to visit, and some people just heard about it, but they didn't really know. The folks who knew the most about it, the teenagers sometimes would go up there and hang out, and, they'd know them, or some of the alternate lifestyle elements, people who, some of the hippies or whatever might have been there before, but, all the rest of the public who'd heard about this place, now that they think they actually can get access to it, and especially when there's this sensational story. I mean, this case made international news. There were tabloids from Europe flying helicopters overhead trying to get pictures. So,
yeah.
it was huge. So everybody wants a piece of it, right? So, there were, people who were trying to, sneak onto the property when it was first gated off, or go on there, later when they finally had access, and take anything and everything they could for a souvenir, so they could feel like they had been a part of this, this famous case. So the chicken house first, and then later the manor wound up getting burnt. The manor, there still remains up there, but there's less and less because it became a thing to take a brick as a souvenir. Well, after a bunch of people had done that, it then became a thing that people started thinking they were cursed if they had taken something from Corpsewood.
Right.
Lots and lots and lots and lots of people reported having car wrecks, their cars died. I think I said something in the book about one guy, and this was a, a pretty credible case about his all four tires falling off of his car. One of the police officers who was there that night, who was highly superstitious and wanted to get out of there before dark, but wasn't able to, his transmission fell out of his car. I didn't even know that could happen, but apparently it did.
Yeah.
On the way out. Yeah. So there were lots of reports like that. So lots of people start bringing those bricks back, and there are piles, of bricks around there. One of the brick walls that continues to remain there, when I'd gone out to take some photos, someone had painted on there, "I took a brick," but, that became a thing. Some people dug up the bushes and took them home, some of the, Joey's plantains or whatever that they had around. Some of those came back too, or were burnt. The stained glass windows, anything people could lay their hands on, they took. A lot of the furniture and things were sold in an auction. And, so there were a lot of people who were buying things there. But, a lot of people would just help themselves to anything that they could find around the area. But like I said, a fair amount of that made its way back.
One of the most remarkable things in this book, of a very remarkable book, is 2 days after you turned in your manuscript for this book, you had a remarkable experience. Tell us about this experience with a masseur.
Okay. Yeah, because I had a lot of weird things that happened while I was writing this book. Like, anytime I was working on it, wherever I was, equipment started malfunctioning or whatever. It was just weird. But this one, this was the best. Yeah, I had a, you know, I'd been sitting there working on this manuscript for months, and my muscles were all knotted up, and so I just turned in the manuscript, and had gone to get a massage just to try to work out some of the kinks. So I'm talking to this guy at the masseuse. He's a young guy, and I'd said, oh, you know, I just finished a book, and oh, what's it about? So I was telling him it was about these two, you know, gay guys that had gotten killed in Chautauqua County before. And he was like, wait, did that happen a long time ago? And I said, yeah, it was back in 1982. And he said, my friends and I went out to that place. And there are, there's a lot of people that still go out, paranormal people, you know, some Church of Satan people, a lot of high schoolers that go out to visit sort of on a dare. He said, my friends and I had gone out when we were young on a dare. To this property, you know, to see the ruins, he said. And he said it was really weird. He said, now, to get to this place, you got to go down a dirt, go to the road, runs out, drive on a dirt road for about a mile, find the right turn, and then pull off in the right driveway. And the driveway here is fairly big enough for one car. I don't know that two cars even could fit in there. But they said they'd gotten there, and there's no other car in the drive. And you have to then hike about a half a mile through the woods to get there. Not easy to find. So no other car there when they got there. And they hiked down to the woods, and they said, even though there'd been no car there, when they get there, in the middle of the ruins of the house, there's these two guys sitting in lawn chairs. And they said they were nice guys. They said they were kind of weird. You know, they were real raggedy looking, but they were real polite. They said one of the guys was real disturbed about, you know, some truck running up and down the road disturbing the peace. But they sat there and told them about what had happened, you know, there in that area. And they said that they came back on the same day every year to meet. And then the fellow who was telling me this, he and his friends went to explore the woods. When they came back, the guys were gone. You know, they never hear them leave. They didn't know how they got there, how they left. They were just gone. And he didn't really think anything about it. He's just telling me about these two weird guys that they met in the woods. But it just sounded so familiar. And I'd heard other people talk about seeing ghosts out there and how they described them. And so I asked him, I said, you know, these two guys, one of them big and the other one little? And they said, yeah. And I said, what color hair did they have? And it's like, oh, the little one had blonde hair, and, you know, the big guy had darker hair. And I had a picture in my car, which at the time I saw it was Charles and Joey. As it turned out, it was Charles and some other guy, but I didn't know that. So I bring that picture in, and I show it to him, and the guy's jaw dropped. And he said, that's the guy. And he's pointing to the picture of Charles. He said, I don't know who this other guy is, but that's one of the guys that we saw out there. And I hadn't told him who this was or anything. I just showed him the picture, you know. And so I said, well, yeah, thing is, these guys have been dead since 1982, you know. So the thing that really made me believe it about the story he was telling me is, like I said, he didn't think he was telling me a ghost story. He just thought he was telling me about a couple of weird guys in the middle of the woods. And I asked him, I said, well, what time of year was this that y'all did this? He said, oh, he didn't really know, but he knew it was cold out. And I said, could it have been December? He said, yeah, it might have. He didn't know for sure. But I'm thinking he was probably out there on the anniversary date of their death, since these guys said they met there on the same day every year. But that was one of the creepiest things that happened out of many weird things that happened while I was writing this book.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Amy, for coming on and talking about this incredible book, The Corpsewood Manor Murders in North Georgia. For those that might want to find out more about this, do you have a Facebook page for this? Do you have a website? Tell us about that.
I do. It's a Corpsewood Manor Murders. I think it's Corpsewood Manor Murders in NorthGeorgia.com. You know, or if you Google it, you'll find it. The book is for sale any place you can buy books, from brick and mortar stores to – you know, Amazon or Walmart.com or, you know, any place they sell books. So
yes.
You can find it in any of those. It's published by History Press. But
yes.
Yeah, it's easy to find.
Yes. Thank you so much. The Corpsewood Manor Murders in North Georgia. It's been a pleasure. Amy Petula, thank you so much. You have a great night.
Thank you so much for
thank
having
you.
Me on. You have a great night, too. Bye-bye.
You too. Good night.
Good night.